your redemption is done. It's complete. It's a sealed deal.
The Levitical priesthood is going on, but God is already declaring there's going to be another one, and it's going to be better.
What then is this bleeding of sheep in my ears?
Is that a Pokemon, or I don't know. Hello, Jason.
Welcome back, Jared, to studio.
Good to be back.
Nice to finally be able to finish what we started a month ago.
Yeah, right. I can't even remember what we talked about, but it was Hebrews, right?
It was Hebrews. Okay, we're not talking about Philemon or Jude.
Or Job.
Or Bell and the Dragon.
Oh, shoot. What about Jubilees?
Oh, we should do a whole episode on the Apocrypha, yes. just to confuse people.
Right. Note to self. Let me read it first.
Yeah. we're gonna wrap up our intro to Hebrews. We were working last time around through some themes, and yeah. I think we'd pretty adequately gotten through the theme of the superiority of Christ.
That's right.
We are going to move ahead now, and we're going to be talking about, do you want to say the word or do you want me to say the word?
Oh, yeah. How the Melchizedekian priesthood of Jesus is superior to the Levitical priesthood.
Gesundheit.
All right.
The Melchizedekian priesthood of Jesus. So start us off. Why Melchizedek? What's going on?
Yeah, well, I just want to, this is in my head, I got to say it. The author of Hebrews seems to even say this is his main point.
No.
Like in 8:1, he says, now the point in what we are saying in this is this, we have such a high priest, right? And so this takes up more space than any other topic, right? The high priesthood of Jesus, right? And so your question, what's the deal with Melchizedek, right? Because he's such kind of a minor figure in the Old Testament, Genesis 14, and then Psalm 110.
And then nowhere else.
Nowhere else.
Except for the book of Hebrews.
Right. It seems like the author of Hebrews is working primarily with Psalm 110:4. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. And then the author of Hebrews makes this point. I think it's in the end of 5:9. And being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him, being designated by God, a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And so that's just one place. But the author is going to draw all these parallels between Melchizedek and Jesus and show how this order, this priesthood, is superior to the order of priesthood after Aaron and the sons of Levi.
So let's do a quick historical recap. Really, I think probably the most straightforward comparison between Jesus and Melchizedek is right at the front of chapter 7.
Yeah, chapter
7.
Where
he does the list, the qualifications or the attributes.
But, that's right.
Melchizedek, you said, shows up Genesis 14.
Mm-hmm.
He shows up after Abraham goes to rescue Lot from the kings, the war between the kings of the valley and another group of kings.
Yeah, there's five kings, Cheddar Larmer and some others. Is that a Pokemon or I don't know. it was these five kings.
He's at the second stage.
Okay, second stage. And so Abraham rescued Lot from these five kings. It was a huge victory. And it was like showing that God is with him. God has truly blessed Abraham and curses those who are against him. And at the end of that battle, this mysterious figure called Melchizedek, priest of Most High God, he comes out with bread and wine, and Abraham gives Melchizedek a tenth of the spoils from that war, and Melchizedek blesses him in the name of the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth.
And that's it.
That's it. Yeah, right?
And he's just like, yeah, that's a totally natural thing to happen completely out of the blue,
right.
And then never again to mention it until you get to the book of Psalms.
Yeah.
But this is one of those things, is that God drops little hints, little kind of nuggets throughout Scripture to tie a thread together. And the writer of Hebrews really picks up on this from Psalm 110. I think we mentioned him in one of the earlier episodes, Philip Edgecombe Hughes.
Yeah.
I think he goes as far as to say the whole book of Hebrews is a sermon on Psalm 110, 1 through 4.
Yeah, that's right.
And then it's those first four verses that really end up being important. So let's jump into Hebrews 7 and talk about what this means. I'll just read the first three verses. It says, this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. And to him, Abraham apportioned a tenth part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, king of righteousness. And then he is also king of Salem, that is king of peace. He is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever.
So maybe we should just hit on each of these four areas in which Jesus resembles
yeah.
Melchizedek. Okay, the first one is mentioned in verse 1. Melchizedek is called priest of Most High God, and Jesus also functions as priest. So that's the first one.
This is the first comparison. This ends up being really important because throughout Hebrews, the superiority of Christ, that theme is the kind of the punchline ends up being Jesus is superior to the Levitical priesthood.
That's right.
And the Melchizedekian priesthood is established even before Levi is born.
Yeah, that's right.
It's Levi, in fact, one of the arguments is that he tithed to Melchizedek through
Abraham.
Yeah,
we'll get there. Yeah. It's of a completely different order. It's not not at all the same thing as the Levitical priesthood. But like you said, Genesis 14 is before the, you know, Aaron, for instance,
yep.
And all that. So first of all, he's priest of Most High God. The second way he resembles is by translation of his names. His name is Melchizedek, which kind of sounds like the Hebrew word for king, Melech, and the word for righteousness, Zedek. So king of righteousness. So this is really kind of cool too, because here we see that Melchizedek not only foreshadows Jesus in being a priest, but also in being a king.
Which is not a normal thing. You usually had one job or the other.
Right.
You weren't both.
Right. And the kings of Judah were not supposed to do the priestly roles or priestly offices. In fact, didn't King Saul get in trouble for doing that?
Yeah. He started, the kingdom started being taken from him. And that's 1 Samuel 15, where he offers the sacrifices instead of waiting for Samuel. One of the funniest lines in scripture, I laugh every time I read it, is Samuel finally shows up late and Saul goes, "I did everything you told me to do," and it was to slaughter everyone. He spared the king,
yeah,
and he spared all the livestock. And Saul goes, "I did everything you told me to do." And then Samuel's response is, "What then is this bleeding of sheep in my ears?"
Exactly.
I laugh every time I read that line.
Yeah. So kings aren't supposed to be priests. Priests aren't supposed to be kings, except for Melchizedek.
Yeah.
He's both, right? He is the king of righteousness, and that's his name. And then his office is priest of Most High God. The other way he resembles the Son of God is that the author of Hebrews says in verse 2, he's king of peace. That refers to the fact that he's king of Salem, which in Hebrew sounds like shalom, which means peace. And
it's probably also king of Jerusalem.
Yeah, that's right. Salem is precursor to Jerusalem.
Yep.
Kind of like Constantinople, Istanbul. Two names, same city, right?
That's nobody's business. That's the Turks.
All right. Fourth way he resembles the Son of God is the most creative.
Yeah.
Verse 3, he is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. Jason, I want to hear your take on this, then I'll give you my take on it.
All right, so the point of this is, and we just went through this passage in my Bible college class on this, it's not unique to not have a genealogy. In fact, one of the church fathers, and I was trying before I came to remember his name, and I didn't have time to look it up, but he's kind of scolding the Jews, and maybe we'll have time at the end of this. The ancient Jewish interpreters get really weird with Melchizedek. It's really fun. But he's like, well, Daniel doesn't have a genealogy. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego don't have genealogies.
Uh-huh.
And so when you look at it, it's this very particular place in Genesis. And you start with there, and it's the generations of, or the Hebrew word is the Toledotes. And we would expect a significant figure here in Genesis to have his genealogy listed, because all of the genealogies of all of the significant people are listed. You know where they came from, why they're there. And so that's, in one hand, is the reality of context. In the other hand, to be a Levitical priest,
You needed to have
a genealogy. You needed to have proof, and that comes later, too.
Uh-huh.
And so neither one of these, in Melchizedek, he doesn't have a genealogy. We don't know who his mom and dad are. We don't know who his ancestors are. We don't know when he was born. We don't know when he died.
Right.
He's just there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of out of the ordinary.
Right. Yeah. I think I agree with that. I think the author is making a lot of hay out of that fact that no genealogy is mentioned in a section in which a lot of genealogies are. His ancestry, his mom and dad aren't mentioned. I don't think the author of Hebrews literally believed that Melchizedek just was eternal. I think he's being kind of creative and playful with the silence about his genealogy in Genesis. And now, so from that kind of creative, playful way of reading Genesis, he's saying that's literally true about Jesus. He literally is forever.
Yeah.
Right.
It's an exercise in typology to make a point.
That's exact. Mm-hmm.
I think it's important, just what you said, that the writer of Hebrews doesn't pull that forward. Like, if that's his first point,
right,
I think the church is kind of getting nervous about that level of interpretation.
Right, right.
But it's kind of like, oh, and this too.
Right, right. He's looking for correspondences between them. And he's like, this is also kind of a correspondence. Because I really want to talk about how Jesus is eternal.
he's looking for a reason to make a point.
Right.
Yeah, well, it works.
Yeah. And should we keep going in chapter 7?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So going on. See, verse 4, see how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. And those descendants of Levi who receive the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from the people, that is, from their brothers, though these also are descended from Abraham. But this man who does not have his descent from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. It is beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the superior. I'll stop there, Jason. So he makes kind of two points already about the superiority of Jesus or superiority of Melchizedek.
Yeah.
Yeah. Want to talk about the first one?
Yeah. So the first one is the tithe.
The tithe. Yeah.
And that's a really, you know, the tithe ends up being an established part of Jewish culture that gets carried forward all the way up until the time of Jesus.
That's
Jesus is talking about the, you know, yelling at the Pharisees, you tithe from your mint and your dill and your cumin. So it's like, imagine going to the grocery store and you bought a bottle of black pepper and you got to take 10% out for Jesus and, you know, that kind of a thing.
Right, right.
But it's a very serious practice.
All
for the
other tribes got inheritances, land allotments, but not the Levites beyond just a little bit. And so this is the way to take care of the Levites and their families.
And the Levites end up tithing to Melchizedek is the argument.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I didn't read that part.
No, you left it off. But so this tithe designates Melchizedek as a really important person, a person of significance, a person of honor.
Right.
A person who's praiseworthy.
Yeah, just the fact that Abraham gave a tenth of the spoils to Melchizedek shows that he is honoring Melchizedek, and it's kind of his way of giving back to the Lord. He knew that this victory over the kings was from the Lord. This is his way of giving back and showing significance. And then the author of Hebrews makes that's kind of another creative point, verse 9. One might even say that Levi himself, who receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of his ancestor when Melchizedek met him.
Yeah. And again, it's fun.
Yeah.
It's playful, but also,
It's true.
There's a good point. One of the other things to note about this in receiving the tithes.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to remember, this might be a Luther thing and it might not be, this also established Melchizedek as the king of peace, because Abraham didn't tithe to the kings who went to war.
Okay.
He tithed to the one who didn't go to war.
Oh, okay, interesting.
It was a designation that Melchizedek is a king of peace because he's not participating in human battles.
Sure, got it. And he was obviously a big deal, right?
Yeah.
The other, beyond paying the tithes, right, it says that after the battle, Melchizedek blessed Abraham, and the author says it's without a doubt that the inferior person is blessed by the superior. So one more way to show that Melchizedek, in this instance, was superior to Abraham. If he was superior to Abraham, he must also be superior to Levi, right?
And I wonder how much that ends up being a good argument for us understanding, like, a passage like John 8.
Okay.
Where Jesus is fighting with the Jews and the Pharisees and the people are following him. And they ask him, are you greater than our father Abraham?
Okay,
you know,
sure.
Everything in Judaism comes back to Abraham.
Yeah, he's the patriarch.
He's the patriarch.
He's the
one who's called out. He's the child of God.
Yep.
And, you know, Jesus is sitting there like, well, yeah, but before Abraham was, I am.
Right.
And so you've got this double application here in Hebrews, is that Jesus is a priest after the order of Melchizedek, the greater blesses the lesser.
Yeah, right.
And you have Jesus' application that, you know, his eternality makes him better than Abraham.
Sure. I'm seeing the connection. I wouldn't have seen it before, but thank you. Yeah, that's
You're welcome.
Yeah, right? So Hebrews 7 continues. I think in Schreiner's commentary, he actually said there are seven arguments for the superiority of Jesus in chapter 7.
Really?
Yeah, there are. And we might not hit all of them, but let's keep going. 11 is cool. 11 begins with 7, verse 11. Now, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need would there be for another priest to arise after the order of Melchizedek, rather than one named after the order of Aaron? And here the point is that, okay, so Psalm 110:4, God declared, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. God made that declaration back when the Psalms were being written, when the Levitical priesthood was still going on. But by the mere fact that God said, there's this priestly order of Melchizedek, that shows that there's something lacking with the Levitical priesthood. Yep. For instance, Jason, what if you got privy to like the school board of trustees notes and they just had some meeting. They didn't mention your name, but they said, you know what, we're going to need another faculty too. And then they go on and list all the things that you're doing right now, you know, and we got to get, I mean, you'd be like, I wonder if my days are numbered here.
Because I'm good at math, I would put one and one together.
Right. And so that's kind of what's happening here. The Levitical priesthood is going on, but God is already declaring there's going to be another one and it's going to be better. And his point is, if perfection had been attainable through the Levitical priesthood, we wouldn't have needed this priesthood after the order of Melchizedek.
And that is the launching point for the rest of this section of Hebrews, is we start off with Jesus is the better priest.
That's right.
And then we end up with Jesus is also the better sacrifice.
Better sacrifice and better covenant.
Better covenant.
Yep.
And like the Levitical priests in making atonement, the first thing they do is had to make atonement for themselves.
That's right.
Jesus doesn't have to do that.
That's right.
And one of the other points, I skipped too far ahead of myself, is that the really interesting thing about the argument here in Hebrews is, and it's either in chapter 8 or chapter 9, that the writer of Hebrews says, like, Jesus wouldn't have even qualified.
Oh, sure.
To have been a Levitical priest.
Right, no, he was like, from the wrong tribe.
It's out of bounds for him,
right,
and
right.
So we needed a priesthood anyway if Jesus is going to be our priest.
That's right.
But it all adds up. Kind of the culmination of this section, in my mind, is the middle of chapter 9.
Okay.
If you want to skip ahead there.
Yeah.
And mostly because it's the passage we most immediately covered. And verses 13 and 14...
In your
chapter
class,
9.
You mean?
Yeah.
In your class, okay.
Yeah. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify the purification of flesh, that's the Levitical task.
Mm-hmm.
The Levites, the Levitical priests, they did atonement and they did cleansing from ceremonial uncleanness. So like if you touched a dead body or things like that. And that's what's being referred to in verse 13. How much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God?
Yeah.
And the argument here, and I don't think I really understood Hebrews until a couple of the commentators put this together. The writer of Hebrews is masterful, is that he doesn't turn his arguments into dichotomies.
Okay, sure.
It's not an either-or choice. It's not a one or the other. The priesthood was good for what it was supposed to do.
Yeah.
But Jesus is better.
That's right.
And that's the argument being made. It's like, okay, all these things in the Levitical priesthood, he's not yelling at the Jews of his day who are thinking about turning away from Christianity back to Judaism and say, no, one or the other guys. He's saying, look, what it worked for, it worked. The problem is you guys are trying to do too much with this thing. And Jesus does it perfectly over here.
Yeah.
And that's the argument being made about the priesthood, why establishing Jesus and the Melchizedekian priesthood is so important.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And like, obviously, the law of Moses and the Levitical priesthood, like you said, it served its purpose. It was right and holy and good. It was God's will. And yet, after the priesthood of Jesus has been established through his once-for-all offering, to turn back, to forsake the offering of Jesus and his priestly ministry, to go back to the temple and try to have peace with God that way, that's really, in Schreiner's words, that's turning back the clock in salvation history.
Yep.
Right? It's just missing the times.
It's working backwards and it's doing something inferior and it doesn't solve the problem.
Right, right.
It was the atonement of the priests, the work of the Levitical priesthood was never, ever intended to save.
That's right.
It was pointing to salvation. And we can look at it that way. But for the ritual cleanness. It worked.
That's right.
The holy water made with the ashes of the heifer, all that was great, but it wasn't meant to be the end.
That's right. So ultimately, that's the clincher, right? The once for all offering of Jesus' yep. blood that actually takes away sins. The blood of bulls and goats, they temporarily did it because they pointed to Christ, but they didn't actually purify our consciences. Jesus' death did. So we have that clincher. I also wanted to note something I learned from studying Hebrews is that it's the resurrection of Jesus is really important for his priesthood as well.
Yeah.
Because in Psalm 110, that declaration from God is you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Well, how can he serve as priest forever? It's by means of his resurrection. And so the author of Hebrews makes this point once. It's by the his priesthood is not based on Mosaic law or on ancestry, but it's based on the power of an indestructible life. And because he is risen and sits at the right hand of God, he continues to serve as this perfect great high priest, whereas none of the Levitical priesthoods could do that.
It's just a successive order of priests who died.
Yeah.
And when the priest dies, you need another priest.
Right.
And then you need another priest. And then you need another priest.
Yeah. And that kind of in itself showed that there's something lacking there. And the fact that they had to continually offer sacrifices day after day, year after year, even there's something in that repetition that suggested what they were doing was incomplete. And yet what Jesus did was absolutely complete. That's why he said, it is finished. That's why Hebrews chapter 1, verse 3 or something says, after making purification for sins, he sat down. You know, job is done.
That's that image pops up multiple times in the book of Hebrews. And the sitting down, the job is done, but the job is done in a divine way because Jesus sits in the presence of God the Father. It's he sits as an equal.
He continually makes intercession.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's this image that takes us out of the priesthood back into the throne room of the King.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus sitting at the right hand of God the Father means he's not an inferior.
That's right.
Which it kind of rules out a Mormon understanding of Jesus' work of atonement because Jesus isn't God in the Mormon church.
Oh, sure. And so what's the practical benefit for us, for sinners, just thinking about how Jesus is a superior priest? How does that benefit you and how does that benefit me?
It benefits us the completion mm-hmm. of the atonement, which is kind of the central argument, you know, like the blood of bulls and goats could never take away sins, is that the outcome of the argument of Hebrews is that your redemption is done. It's complete. It's a sealed deal. We can translate that into we fit into the theme because we're always tempted to turn away from Christianity to something that is more convenient, something that feels easier, something that feels more tangible and real. Is like Hebrews 2 or 3, we do not yet see him.
Yeah.
We do not yet see everything in submission to him. It frequently looks like the church is losing.
Right.
It doesn't look like Jesus is in charge. And so the temptation is to find our answers somewhere else, but Jesus is the answer, and it's because of his completed work of redemption and because of his resurrection.
Yeah, amen. And just personally, anytime I have a bad conscience, right, a conscience that's convicting me of sin, I pray and I ask forgiveness, and passages like these ones from Hebrews reminds me that my sin is forgiven. Not only because of what Jesus did 2,000 years ago, but also because he is in the presence of God. He is interceding for me with his prayers, with his blood. And through Jesus, through his sacrifice, through his high priesthood, I can draw near to God and receive not God's wrath, not his frown, but his blessing and his smile and his grace and his embrace.
Yeah.
So that's been one of my favorite things, just the practical help it gives me when I have a conscience that needs cleansing and forgiveness.
Well, I think if we talk any more about the book of Hebrews, we're going to need another episode or a whole series of episodes. So this is probably a good point for us to start. Hopefully it works. Good introductory material for people who are looking to dive into the book of Hebrews. One of the most recommended books that I give when someone asks, well, what should we study in church? What book should we be studying? I think Hebrews is immensely practical and relevant for Christians and looking to study scripture.
Yeah. Best sermon ever, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Jason. It's been fun.
Yeah, thanks, Jared.